From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
The connection between hands-on learning and thinking is very important. This is not a phenomenon that's gone away, nor is its essential connection, which is between doing hands-on work and understanding what you're doing.
That's sociologist Richard Sennett. He's out to redefine craft as anything you commit yourself to doing to the best of your ability, simply for the sake of a job well done. He says plenty of working-class people, by his definition, are craftsmen. And neuroscientist Keller Lambert just might agree with him. Take the example of working in a garden.
We're still carrying around a brain that appreciates working with dirt and planting and preparing food, and we still have to respect that brain.
Making things by hand, sometimes quite extraordinary things, seems to be a basic human impulse, even under the unimaginable conditions of slavery. Many museums proudly display the clay pots thrown by a slave known to history as Potter Dave. Leonard Todd made it his business to learn all he could about Dave.
This was a real shock for me. I discovered that my ancestors had owned Dave.
Richard Sennett teaches sociology at New York University in the London School of Economics. He's written over a dozen books of social science, as well as three novels. His latest volume, The Craftsman, names a basic human impulse, the desire to do a job well for its own sake. Although the word craftsman may suggest a way of life that disappeared with the rise of industrial society, Sennett argues that craft means far more than skilled manual labor. In fact, he told Steve Paulson, it suggests ways of using tools, organizing work, and thinking about materials that remain viable ideas for how to conduct your life.
We often learn what something is about, even in the most abstract way, by practical, concrete activity with it. That was obvious, you know, in the age when artisan craftsmen produced most of the things we had. They didn't have many machines. They had to think about what they were doing constantly. The hand and the head were joined together. You couldn't easily separate them. People think that now that's no longer the case, that those artisanal crafts have disappeared, that people can do things abstractly without reference to, you know, concrete practices, to actually getting into the guts of something, hands-on knowledge, and so on. And the point of my book is to challenge all that. The connection between hands-on learning and thinking is very important. And it's important for people who do service work to think about, you know, every concrete instance of what they do rather than simply follow procedures. So my argument is that if we expand a little the definition of craftsmanship to think about it as doing a job well, getting skill, and wanting to do the job well for its own sake, that this is not a phenomenon that's gone away, nor is its essential connection, which is between doing hands-on work and understanding what you're doing.
So this could apply to a doctor or a cello player, I suppose a computer programmer, as well as sort of the traditional kinds of craftspeople, you know, quilters, stonemasons, woodworkers.
Absolutely. And historically, this division between art and craft came about for a kind of social reason, that in the Renaissance, people began to think that art concerned expressing something inside individuals.
Mm-hmm. Originality.
Whereas, yes, exactly. Whereas craft was a set of shared practices. But if you look at actual Renaissance artists like Cellini, for instance, he was a sculptor and he was a goldsmith. Many painters worked in ateliers long before, you know, they stood out as individuals. It's a very ambiguous line. And I'm uneasy about it, Steve, because I feel that emphasizing the difference between art and craft in a way sort of impoverishes the actual expression we can make. It focuses too much on our motives and not what we actually accomplish or achieve.
Hmm. I mean, that's interesting because I think sort of the conventional wisdom would say that people who make violins would be craftsmen, but Stradivari was an artist because he elevated it to a new level. But you're not willing to make that kind of distinction.
The reason I'm unhappy about it is that it leads us to think that sort of the mass of people, you know, can do crafts, but only the exceptional person can stand out as an artist or as a scientist. Many people, many, many people have the capacity to do good work and to take pride in doing a good job. We're very elitist, particularly in the U.S., I think, about this. You know, we assume that the better it is, the fewer the people who can do it. If you hold everybody to the Stradivarius standard and say if it's not a Stradivarius, it's worthless, you're really doing something that's, I think, quite destructive. The equivalent of that is what we tend to do in modern society. You know, we're only looking for the few people who stand out rather than developing the capacities of most people. And I think most people have the capacity to be motivated and to realize doing a good job.
And this goes back to your definition of craftsmanship, which is the desire to do a job well for its own sake.
Right. And sort of the lower down the class hierarchy you go, the more important that is, because, you know, many working class people aren't getting much recognition. I did interviews with hospital orderlies, hospital workers, sort of at the bottom of the medical pole. And those people, you know, cared about their patients, they cared about keeping them clean, keeping their rooms clean, and so on. Even though it rarely meant anything for their paycheck, and they weren't going to go anywhere in their jobs. That's craftsmanship.
Mm-hmm. Now, historically, craftsmanship also often involved a long learning period. I mean, there was the whole notion of the apprentice, and wasn't it often years, maybe even decades, before you stopped being an apprentice, before you became a, quote, master craftsman?
Yeah, 7 years. To move from being an apprentice to a journeyman and then another 3 or 4 to being a master. There's an interesting statistic about this. There's something called the 10,000-hour rule, and it's a rough rule of thumb about how long it takes to become so skilled in doing a complicated task that you can do it confidently without having to think too much or doubt too much what you're doing. But this 10,000-hour rule seems to apply to people learning to be proficient in sports, learning how to be good, you know, well-skilled as musicians, how long it takes to, if you're a surgeon, to be really comfortable doing surgery. And the reason for it is that it's an estimate of the time that it takes not to do something right as a one-off, but to know through continual practice and through looking at what you're doing, being self-critical about what you're doing, to have the confidence to know that you can do it again and again and again. One of the problems in our schools is that, you know, multiple choice tests and the fear of boring kids means that oftentimes we deprive people of that 10,000-hour rule span of experience. You know, the moment they can do one thing well, they're pushed on to do the next. And it's not a good way to learn. Something similar happens in a lot of forms of flexibilized work. Think about business consultants, for instance, who flit from place to place, task to task, job to job. They're kind of Renaissance men light or Renaissance women light. Really knowing something isn't ingrained in that kind of work. And, you know, our economy is increasingly privileges Renaissance light as a way of being flexible in the job force. What I'm arguing in the book is that that kind of superficial competence is not real craftsmanship. It's not real engagement. It's not depth.
Do you see a morality to craftsmanship? I mean, other than just trying to do good work? I mean, are you partly talking about what it means to live well?
I pondered a lot the case of Robert Oppenheimer, you know, one of the leaders in the invention of the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
when Oppenheimer was out at Los Alamos in the process of, you know, fabricating the bomb and getting it to work, somebody asked him about the ethics of making this weapon that would destroy hundreds of thousands of people. And at that moment, he responded, well, when you see a technical problem that's sweet, you just get on with it and you worry about the ethical consequences later. When Oppenheimer went out to the test site and the first bomb went off, and, you know, they'd never seen light or glare like this, he remarked in his diary that evening, I've become the god of death. And he was appalled at what he had done. And that's an ethical problem, that often the issue of getting something to work clouds our judgment about whether it's going to be destructive or constructive for other people. It's impossible for the craftsman to really know easily, as an individual, in advance, whether something he or she is working on is going to harm other people. I've heard many technicians talk about this. It's not our problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think about scientists in particular who are working on something new, often, you know, a new kind of discovery or technology, and who knows what's going to become of it later.
Right. I thought a lot about this, about the need to invent, you know, new kinds of tools and procedures for dealing with energy and ecological issues. They may turn out to be destructive, the way biofuels are turning out to be something more destructive than we thought about. You know, we're not done with this tension at all.
Richard Sennett calls his latest book The Craftsman. He talked about it with Steve Paulson. On a wintry Saturday morning in downtown Milwaukee, visitors to the 4th annual Art vs. Craft Fair lined up around the block, waiting for the doors to open. Inside, vendors set out hand-bound books and felted mittens, crocheted iPod cases, and jewelry made from bottle caps. Anne Strainchamps and Kirill Owen were there to take a look at the grassroots indie craft movement that is sweeping the country.
My name is Bridget Hansen. I'm from Illinois, Grays Lake, Illinois. I make hand-spun yarn, hand-spun and hand-dyed yarn, felted jewelry, and make little pouches and bags.
My name is Bobby Ludwig, and right now I'm spinning yarn. I spin all different types of yarn, and I'm very much about color, so I use a lot of very, very bright colors. I spin bamboo fiber. Bamboo fiber is very shiny. It's like silk, but it's more durable like cotton. And again, it's all been hand-dyed.
If the words craft fair call up visions of macrame potholders and tie-dyed T-shirts, think again. In cities across the country, fairs like this one are going on, part of a grassroots, underground crafts revival spearheaded by 20 and 30-something indie artists, like these folks.
Liam Hughes from Milwaukee. I make jewelry out of antique and contemporary broken china dishes. So everything you see was once a dinner plate or a teacup, a saucer, a platter. I find plates in antique stores, on trash heaps. There's even I live in Ireland in the summer, and I find there's a beach I go to, and I find china dishes washed up and bits and pieces of them, and I create jewelry out of them.
My name is Molly McKee, and I make sock monkey sort of animals. They are kind of non-traditional. Many of them have teeth. Some of them have fingernails. A new thing this year is a lot of them have claws. I don't know, because I feel like this weird thing, whenever I make them, there's always a personality that comes through, and it is like kind of like that fun thing of like reacting to like the color and the shape of the sock, and then it kind of creates this little personality.
This is definitely not your grandma's hippie macrame, or even Martha Stewart's suburban chic. New wave crafters subscribe to alt-modernist magazines like Craft and Ready Made. They share patterns and comment on each other's work on web forums like Etsy.com and Craftser.org. They meet at stitching lounges for crafternoons or make and takes at their local Church of Craft. And this is going on not just in one or two cities, but all over the world.
It's fairly large. I'd say that it's definitely international. But as for the United States, it's like you can find little hubs in almost every city.
Courtney Heimerl and Faith Levine are artists, crafters, and filmmakers. They recently documented the growing handmade scene in a film called Handmade Nation. Faith, who founded the Milwaukee Art vs. Craft Fair, says one of the most striking things to her about the new wave of craft is that it's as much about ethics and economics as it is about aesthetics.
There is a large part of the DIY art and craft community that has, I think, political motivations or at least some sort of consciousness behind what they're making.
And that comes across loud and clear when you talk to the vendors. Whether they're using recycled materials or creating affordable art, the very act of making something is, for a lot of people here, political.
My name is Rebecca, and I make letterpress-printed postcards and screen-printed T-shirts. I do a lot of handset type and a lot of more play on, like, catchphrases my friends say and hip-hop music. And I like making work that people can afford, and so by making postcards, I can make little $3 prints that people can either send in the mail or put on their fridge or put in a frame. And I just like making art affordable.
My name's Christina Ward. I love making stuffed animals. I learned from my grandma. I think that there's so much artfulness in so much handiwork and craft. And I think a lot of that's been lost. We don't make anything anymore. Our economy is all about serving other people or serving the money. And I think if we got back to the idea of craft, of creating things, of making things, our economy would be better off. And that, I think, in and of itself is an art.
So who are these young people who are suddenly feeling an irresistible urge to make sock monkeys or hammer broken pottery into necklaces? Why are whole swaths of 30-year-olds with advanced degrees in everything from art history to environmental toxicology giving it all up to start cottage industries, making letterpress postcards and clothespin dolls?
I was living in New York, and I just moved there. I didn't know anybody, and I was working at a publishing house, and we were at a meeting one morning, and I just turned to them and I was like, I want to learn to knit so I can hang out in nursing homes, because I was like missing my grandmother and everything. And to my surprise, everybody else in the room raised their hands and said that they'd knit as well. And none of them knew. They were all like closeted knitters, which was weird. I mean, the whole room was like, you knit too? And they're like, wow, I thought it was only me.
Betsy Greer is a political activist and blogger, founder of the website craftivism.com, and author of Knitting for Good, a guidebook for creating social change through craft. Today, she epitomizes the socially conscious crafters you find at art fairs all over the country. But back when she first started knitting, there was something kind of subversive about it.
Those of us that learned in our late 20s, it was kind of shocking, especially if we had grown up being feminists and, you know, oh, you know, smash the patriarchy and all that, you know. And I've had, you know, lots of conversations of people being worried that were like, I'm knitting, you know, and maybe that leads to baking. And so when I started knitting, my family, my friends, strangers would stop and be like, you knit? They're like, I would expect you to be out piercing strangers or like, you know, giving tattoos on the street before I would expect you knitting.
Greer honed her knitting skills and street creds in the UK, where she took part in the fledgling public knitting movement. She and her fellow stitching activists held knit-ins on street corners and in the London Metro, and little by little they brought knitting out of the closet.
A lot of men would come up to me and they'd be like, so, my mom used to knit. And it would get kind of creepy sometimes. You'd be like, uh-huh, okay, great, you learned. He's like, and my grandma just reminds me of being a kid. And I'm like, okay, great, thanks. Kind of weird. And then people, they would also come up and ask me to knit them things as like a pickup line. And I was like, and no.
Today, of course, you're as likely to see a goth girl knitting on the subway as a grandmother. And there are now dozens of ways you can knit for progressive politics, from making Afghans for children in Afghanistan to tagging public street signs with hand-knit graffiti. And it's not just knitting. Greer says that for her generation, making things by hand has become a form of cultural resistance, a way of striking back against a culture of mass production in which everything is the same.
You know, you buy a shirt at the mall and then you go out, you know, to get coffee, and five people are wearing the same shirt when you're getting coffee. And so it kind of makes you think about who you are and your identity. And that's kind of almost a new concept to a lot of people as well, is like, wait, I don't have to go out and buy something. I don't have to go buy a piece of ready-made clothes. That I have an option to make something. And I really like that.
And back at Milwaukee's Art vs. Craft Fair, the shoppers seem to like it too.
I think it comes from the heart, and there's a lot of pride in what the people do, and a lot of the people here also use recycled materials, which I think is really important also. The selection, and also to buy local and handmade this year, definitely. I love the skeyettes. They use vintage fabrics, and if I don't buy anything else, I'm going back for a dress.
I just bought one of these beautiful rosette hats. I think they're called cloche hats for my sister.
Have you come here before?
This is my second year in a row. Yeah. Just wonderful artistry, creative, one-of-a-kind gifts.
I like the pink one.
Nothing from Amazon or Best Buy. Everything is handmade. It's just beautiful stuff.
Are you doing a lot of Christmas shopping?
Most of my Christmas shopping, yes.
If you're looking for some fun art or some fun fashion or something decorative, you can come here and really get something totally left field, just bizarre and fun and very personal. You know, the people that make everything put a lot of their own heart and soul into it.
And when they were done with their piece, Anne Strainchamps and Kirill Owen did a little shopping, too. Handmade Nation has a website. Come to ours and we'll link you there. And while you're visiting, you can get more information about the music and the books featured in the show. Our address is ttbook.org. We always like to hear from you. Coming right up, Jessica Helfand tells us the secret of American scrapbooks.
Scrapbooks and photo albums are really asynchronous, and I think that's what's so beautiful and compelling about them.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Some Americans are turning their life stories into art. Scrapbooking has become a noun and big business. Craft stores across the nation feature the latest in thematic page-making and decorating accessories to make memory books on every conceivable topic. But Americans kept scrapbooks of amazing beauty and complexity long before they had any commercial help. That's what Jessica Helfand found when she researched her gorgeous new book called Scrapbooks in American History. She says people just got on with telling the story they wanted to tell.
People very often didn't start at the beginning and go to the end. It's in and out, and they go backwards and forwards and rip things out and change their mind and add different color inks. And so if you're sort of approaching it in an analytical, almost forensic way, you really can't just assume to start at the beginning and to go to the end tells the story. There are many internal narratives that sort of feed through the general arc of the major story, and it's sort of up to the person looking at the scrapbook to try to dissect and figure out, in fact, what was going on, sometimes over many, many years.
They are stories, but I gather also from looking through the variety in your book that sometimes these stories aren't obvious. In some cases, you're not even sure where the real story is.
It's an excellent point, I think, because certainly in today's world, all of us tend to move very quickly through any kind of way that we process information. And these things really demand that you slow down and listen and look and don't assume. And I found also it was quite humbling to me that after looking at some 200 scrapbooks, the 201st didn't come to me any more swiftly as a result of that trajectory. I had to still begin slowly. And in some cases, I had to go offline and look at the ancestral records of the person or the town in which they lived or the time in which they lived and to try to kind of patch together the story that might not be so declarative the way you would perhaps in a diary write very much first person. These things are much more kind of anecdotal and piecemeal, as you say.
Were you surprised as you began to look at all the different scrapbooks? Were you surprised by how many and how varied they were?
I was indeed, and I had to limit myself. I had to limit myself to American scrapbooks. I limited myself to a period, about 1870 to about 1945. I felt that once television entered the living room, the imagination that people had visually to create things that put pictures and words together was somewhat, I think, supplanted by the fact that there was a television bringing the outside world in. And so while people continued to make scrapbooks in the 50s and 60s and 70s, they tend to be a little bit more monotonous in terms of their content. They, lots of Route 66 maps and motel postcards and a kind of flattening out of the kinds of materials I'd seen earlier. I mean, some of the things I found, for example, in the 1910s and 20s, you know, the things during women's suffrage, for example, before women could vote, how women expressed their concern about the war, the way people processed World War I versus the way they processed World War II when women could vote and could volunteer and could be part of an effort that was much more inclusive. The fact that there was no Scotch tape before 1929. And so to glue something in a book required quite a bit of imagination. All of these things were interesting to me because they really helped me understand how a composite visual picture of a life could actually be made. And it wasn't, there were no pre-existing commercially available supplies such as there are today. Not to denigrate these supplies, because I think some of them are marvelous and they're archival, and some of the reproduction ephemera, as much as it sounds like an oxymoron, really will last into the next century. But I find that there is such an emphasis on buying store-bought things to tell a story that is your own that it creates a kind of meaningless visual grammar. And I wrote this book in part to tell this backstory, but also to look at this very, I think, vivid and genuine form of visual biography that I think in many ways is quintessentially American.
This book is filled with photographs of scrapbooks from many periods in time. I'm curious, I guess, as to what it was about 1870. Was that simply the oldest American scrapbook that you found?
No, there are many older ones. Thomas Jefferson kept scrapbooks. And if you go back to commonplace books and extra illustrated books and Grangerite books, which I talk about briefly in my introduction, they tend to be interesting depending on the person who was writing them, of course. But what happens, I think, in any kind of visual history is that you make what you can make based on the tools available to you at any time. And I didn't want to organize the book chronologically because then I would just be talking about black and white printing giving way to color printing. And I wanted to organize it around bigger ideas that had to do with the people who kept these books and why they chose to do so. But I think that one thing that I found around 1870 is when Mark Twain patented a self-pasting scrapbook. And I love this for two reasons. One, obviously, that we think of scrapbooking as a gendered activity, and this was a man, a prolific writer, who it is said, although it may be apocryphal, that he made more money from the self-pasting patent than he did from all of his fiction combined. The second thing was that when I was sitting at the Beinecke researching this, I actually found the patent application in which he wrote this very long piece of prose that declared that this was really actually a good thing for the church, because if you were a scrapbook enthusiast, come Sunday morning, you could never find your paste, and you would walk around the house swearing. And so if blasphemy wanted to be put under control, it would be really good to create this thing that you... And sure enough, it was, you know, you put water on it, and it was self-pasting. But he had this rationale that was based on, you know, reducing blasphemy in the home. So I thought that was kind of a nice, you know, energizing way to start the book. And then I was very interested in what was going on at the turn of the century. And the fact that, you know, you look at scrapbooks from 1900... and scrapbooks from 1920, and the things people are doing in 1920 are much more dramatic visually. People are cutting off heads, decapitating arms and legs, combining words and pictures in a much more kind of reckless abandon, and a much more adventurous spirit. And these are people who had no idea what was going on in Europe, but in Dada and the salons across Europe. And so it was interesting to me to look and see if there was actually some kind of modernist tendency as time wore on between the wars in which people used their scrapbooks to try to express what they were feeling, what was going on around them, and who they were.
You do have to read each story several times, don't you? Because it tells a different story depending on how you look at it. But when you start to look at the story, it gives you a sense of who the person was that you probably couldn't get from a journal entry.
I think that's true. And I think also there's a subtlety to the way people saved things, what they wrote, what they didn't write. I think that omission is actually extremely important, or annotation, crossing someone's name out. I had a scrapbook from a woman who was married in the 60s who wrote all her ambitions on the front page, and the bottom one was housewife. And then she goes in to include all the photographs of her friends and went back later in a more mature handwriting and wrote who was divorced, who ran off with whom, who did what. And you can see that
even though she may not have been happy being that housewife, she was going to put cement on the page, those pictures and that annotation, to say that she was still married and she still had children and she still had a house, and so she was okay. In another case, a woman who was a very young woman when the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped saves a picture of the child's baby booties on one side, and on the other side, in a very awkward handwriting, draws her family tree and the ages of her baby brothers at her age. And you can see her literally working out how she would deal with such a tragedy were it to have happened in her own family. And so sometimes you have playful juxtapositions, like a picture of Rudy Valentino next to a prayer card, or a laundry list next to a college diploma, or a gum wrapper next to, you know, a wedding bouquet. And other times you have things where you really can see this very palpable emotional need to work things out on paper by making a curious little family tree next to a picture of the Lindbergh baby.
These are such personal documents that you'd think that they would be treasured family possessions. But I gather even in your own family, you were surprised to discover a scrapbook that you should have had that was up in somebody's attic.
My grandmother's scrapbook was found by a cousin of mine after she died, and we just loved it because it had all these pictures of her and our grandfather frolicking with their friends in 1916, 17, 18. And, you know, we remember them as very serious people and, you know, sort of the head of the family. And the idea that, you know, she had a dance card filled with names that weren't my grandfather was kind of fun. And we wondered, you know, did she not show it to us on purpose? Did she not know that it was there? It wasn't one of the more beautiful scrapbooks I found, but of course it was poignant to me. And you're absolutely right. You can't believe some of these scrapbooks that they would secede from the families that belong to them. And in some cases, I have actually traced the families and I'm giving the scrapbooks back. And that's been a very interesting exercise. I don't think I thought when I began this project that I would be doing that. But in some cases, it's been quite a rewarding thing to take it full circle.
We've talked about these almost exclusively as though they were put together by women. But in fact, that's not the case. One of them that I found fascinating was, I think his name is Francis Johnson, Pop Johnson.
Pop Johnson. Pop Johnson was from Waterbury, Connecticut, and he worked in a tool and die manufacturing plant, and he never really left Waterbury, Connecticut, except to go to war. And his scrapbook is filled with his dog tags and his fingerprints and his ration cards and wonderful things, sad things, friends that he lost, taped in obituaries from young men who served with him, very crudely drawn maps where he traces in crayon where he goes overseas. And we actually tracked some of his family members down. They all want the scrapbook. There's rather a bidding war going on in his family at the moment. But it was very, very touching because he married and later divorced. He had no children. Interestingly, many of the scrapbooks that I'm finding where I have traced the families, it's because there were no children. And I don't think that I put that together until just now in describing this to you. And it's not that any of these families are any more important than any other. They were rich, poor, East Coast, West Coast, all sorts of regions all across the United States. But I think what's so interesting when you start to really deconstruct them is how many similarities there were. I mean, everybody was concerned about things during the Depression or worried about things during the war or happy when the war was over. I mean, there were certain universal symptoms that revealed themselves in the pages of these scrapbooks. People say things about Christmas and New Year's and birthdays and weddings. I mean, there's certain episodic details that every family goes through. But interstitially between those details is where the real stories happen. And that's what took so long and was really so much fun to try to excavate.
Jessica Helfand is the author of Scrapbooks, An American History. In some families, the urge to make things goes way back, which doesn't surprise neuroscientist Kelly Lambert.
We still have the same brain our ancestors did, and a lot of people are more scared of a spider than they are a gun or a bomb because our brains haven't caught up.
The science of making crafts, up next. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. The best reason to engage in a craft, any craft, is because you enjoy it. But what if you're lost in that numbing fog called depression and you can't enjoy anything? Kelly Lambert chairs the psychology department at Randolph-Macon College in Virginia and is the author of Lifting Depression. She told Anne Strainchamps that getting busy with your mind and both hands in some crafty way may do you as much good as popping Prozac.
It seems simplistic, and I know we get carried away with biomedical models, with neurotransmitters and neurochemicals, and I am a neuroscientist, so I get excited about that as well. But when you think about planning an activity, using all of that brain area and real estate to move your hands and working with that and seeing, and this is, I think, critical for depression, seeing an end result that makes your brain smile, so to speak, that is rewarding to you. Because I was able to show that the area of our brain that's involved in pleasure, it's called the nucleus accumbens, and it releases dopamine, a reward neurochemical, has close connections with an area of the brain that controls our body and then shoots toward the prefrontal cortex that's involved in decision-making and more executive skills. And so there are rich connections with movement and with the limbic emotional brain and with the thinking part of the brain. So it's very engaging, incredibly engaging, to plan something, to use both of our hands in tandem, to work with it, and to see that result. Even though that seems simplistic, and it might be gardening or knitting or doing some other craft, that is more engaging and complex than taking a single neurochemical in the form of a pill out of the context of our real life. Our brains we still have the same brain our ancestors did, and I tell my students when we talk about anxieties and phobias, a lot of people are more scared of a spider than they are a gun or a bomb because our brains haven't caught up. We're very predisposed to be scared of germs and insects. And even though things can be much more dangerous, we're not prepared to have that phobic kind of response to it. So we're still carrying around a brain that appreciates, you know, working with dirt and planting and hunting and preparing food. And we still have to respect that brain. I'm not saying that we don't need technology, but it might be helpful to use both hands in a crafty kind of ways and with things that you actually enjoy and where the movement is meaningful.
So as a neuroscientist, do you have any idea what's actually happening in the brain when, for instance, someone knits?
Yeah. I spent some time actually reading about the history of knitting. Took some cups of coffee to get through that. But I found that about 100 years ago, physicians would prescribe knitting to women who were, quote, overwrought with anxiety. The physicians were picking up that it was calming them in some way. Knowing what I know about different behaviors and neurochemicals and emotional resilience and calm, today I would argue that, one, researchers have shown that repetitive movement, such as you would have with the knitting needles, increases serotonin, which is the very neurochemical that the antidepressants increase. And that has some calming effect. Also, if you're knitting something that you enjoy seeing, a scarf that you're going to give to someone, seeing that is rewarding. And you're thinking about it and anticipating giving that as a gift or wearing that. Also, counting the stitches is a way to distract you from things that you may be worried about. So it kind of forces your thoughts away from thinking about that relationship or the job or the economy or stock market today. And again, you're using both hands in a coordinated kind of complex way that's engaging the brain. It's kind of like sit-ups or push-ups or some exercises for the brain. I talk about this as being kind of like mental vitamins.
We mentioned the neurotransmitters, serotonin, for instance, which you know, by now has made headlines.
Yes, it's a celebrity neurochemical.
Right. But so a lot of research on depression over the last few years has really focused on neurotransmitters, serotonin, but others as well. Your focus, though, seems like is less on one particular neurotransmitter and more on a whole circuit. And that sounds to me like it's kind of a different model of looking at depression.
Yes. What I did, I just went back to the drawing board to try to map out all the symptoms of depression. It's a very complex disorder, what we call depression. We have reduced pleasure. We're not happy like we usually are. We have more profound sadness, fatigue. Our sleep-wake cycles might be altered. A lot of different symptoms. So I started to look at, okay, which area of the brain is involved in reward and pleasure? Which area is involved in this fatigue and movement and worry and executive thinking and this something that I call the effort-driven reward circuit, where if we direct effort toward a goal and see a product, we're engaging the brain, and I think this is positive. When we don't do this and we're sitting in our chairs on our rear ends and not using our hands in very interesting ways, I think that it kind of dampens and numbs our brains, and we're less motivated to do things. So I started talking about this circuit. I'd learned from some neuroscientists who I respect, and they had told me one area of the brain is not sitting next to another one for no reason. They're in proximity because they're working as a circuit. And I think if we want to really respect the brain and approach these things in a respectful way, we have to appreciate this. So dopamine is involved in pleasure. Serotonin might be involved in this repetitive movement. Endorphins are involved when we exercise, which is another form of movement. We may or may not be using our hands with it. So there are a lot of neurochemicals that come together that could produce the state that we call depression. And given that, we can kind of get to it from a lot of different angles as well. So it's messier. It's not as clean as saying you're depressed because you have low levels of this neurotransmitter and you can take this pill, it will fix everything. The research just does not support that when you get into the scientific literature.
Mm. So you're suggesting that it would make more sense to look at a kind of multiple causation theory in a way.
Multifaceted kind of model.
Right, that it's not just serotonin, not just dopamine, and that perhaps it's not the serotonin that's making people feel better.
Exactly. That's an indirect downstream effect. So our efforts and the way we're engaging our brain, I tell my students, if you think about our ancestors who just hung out on the couch in the cave, I don't think these cave potatoes really made it. We had to keep going. We had to keep finding the resources and putting things together and building and creating. And that took our hand. Our brain needed to motivate us to do that. So I worry about when we are too inactive and things are too easy. Just at the press of a button, we have our food, we have all of these resources. I don't think it's too good for our brains.
Kelly Lambert is the author of Lifting Depression, a neuroscientist's approach to activating your brain's healing power. She talked with Anne Strangechamps. Tough to think of anything more elemental than a hand-thrown pot. Imagine the potter shaping the very stuff of the earth itself, transforming simple clay into artful shapes, both beautiful and useful. Now go a step further. Imagine the potter's hands are black and belong to a slave we know today as Potter Dave. Your last imaginary step, and I want to warn you, it's a big one, is recognizing that the history of Potter Dave's family is inextricably bound up with your own. That's what Leonard Todd discovered. He's a writer and graphic designer, a former Fulbright scholar, and a graduate of Yale. His latest book is called Carolina Clay, The Life and Legend of the Slave Potter Dave. Todd told Steve Paulson that after years as a New Yorker, he went home to Edgefield, South Carolina.
Like most Southerners, I had been raised with the sort of general knowledge that perhaps somewhere in the past my family had owned slaves, but it was long ago, far away. There were no names. It was something that we just didn't think about very much, but here was something that I couldn't ignore. It was a man with a name and a story, and in fact, a man very much like myself.
Of course, the circumstances could not be more different between you and Dave the Potter. For one thing, there was no one else like him. I mean, a slave who not only made pots, but actually signed them and wrote on them. I mean, that was just unheard of.
In all of the years of pottery in Edgefield, Edgefield was a center of Southern pottery production. No slave had ever signed his name to his pots, and no one after Dave did either. So he was unique in that sense. And then in addition to that, of course, he also wrote original poems on his jars, which is astonishing. And especially when you realize that in South Carolina, for generations there had been great fear of slave literacy because it was thought by the slave owners of South Carolina that any education given to slaves would permit them to ask questions, to have ideas, to make decisions on their own, becoming thereby less slaves and more a danger to the status quo.
Well, and it was illegal for slaves to learn how to read and write, and they could be severely beaten. They could probably be killed if it was found out that they could read and write.
They could certainly be punished severely, and there were threats to cut off their forefinger if they learned to write. And the way he was able to continue to openly exhibit his poems and his signature, I believe, was that he made himself one of the best-known slaves in the entire district. He entertained at his wheel. He welcomed visitors. He wrote poems openly. He used large, impressive words. The Edgefield Advertiser, the newspaper, noted that he had an intelligent twinkle in his eye. So if he did all of this as a conscious defense against those who would hurt him, it worked brilliantly. By hiding nothing, he seems to have been able to do almost anything.
Well, it also sounds like he took some ownership in his art. I mean, that's what signing a piece of art is really all about.
Well, absolutely. He did, and that's what's so, I think, important about Dave, is that he rose above the station of a slave at that time and did things that no other slave had ever done in Edgefield, and I think served as a model, an example for the other slaves around him, that even though they were yoked in bondage, they could still hold their heads high.
What do Dave's pots look like?
Dave's pots are magnificent. They range in size from small churns and jugs to enormous food storage jars. They are all utilitarian because they were simply for use on the plantation. They were not art objects. They were not thought of as art objects. They were simply utilitarian pieces to hold the great amount of food that was necessary to feed slaves at that time. And Dave, however, just brought something more to these pots. Many people in Edgefield, many potters made these pots, but Dave's were special because they were larger, for one thing, than anyone else's. He made food storage jars that could hold up to 40 gallons, which is enormous. In fact, there are twin 40-gallon jars at the Charleston Museum in Charleston, South Carolina, which can be seen by the public. And they both have poems written on them. They both have Dave's signature. And they are absolutely astonishingly large. You can't even reach around them. And Dave made them both on the same day. It was an astonishing feat. And potters today stand in awe of his achievement.
Hmm. And some of his poems are, well, pretty much all of his poems are very short. I mean, they're often just two lines and very evocative. For instance, there is one that goes, give me silver or either gold, though they are dangerous to our soul.
Exactly. Yes. His poems are usually couplets written in iambic tetrameter. And they speak of his daily life. They speak of his surroundings, what he has seen on the plantation. They speak of his friends, his loved ones. And more often than not, they speak of the actual jar that he's writing on. He often referred to his pots as noble jars. One of his beautiful descriptions is great and noble jar, which exhibits what he thought of his work and what deep regard he held for what he had made.
Part of the story is about uncovering the mystery of who Dave was, but it's also a story about your own ancestors. You're trying to find out who your family was. Do you feel like you got a better sense of that?
Well, I certainly did. I had to. I started with zero. I knew absolutely nothing about my Edgefield family. This was my mother's father's family. And I only knew that they had lived in Edgefield. I knew that my great-grandfather had been given a silver sword on the steps of the Edgefield courthouse by the citizens of Edgefield for his gallantry, they termed it, in the war with Mexico. And I knew their names, and that was all I knew. I didn't know about the pottery. I didn't know where they lived or anything. So every time I discovered something about Dave, I also discovered something about my family, which made it extremely personal for me and moving and sometimes very disturbing. But that's what you whenever you go back in your family history, you have to be ready for anything. And I accepted whatever I found. I reported it. I tried not to judge it. And I left it for the reader to make up his or her mind about these men and women who owned Dave. And even though I felt close to them, they were my family, I just had to let it go.
How do you think Dave's masters treated him?
We know that Dave had six owners during his life, all of which are connected to me in my family tree. And I think it varied from owner to owner. One of my family, I think, was not an enlightened owner. I think he was frightened, and I think he treated his slaves very severely. On the other hand, there are others, Dave's first owner, whose name was Harvey Drake, who I believe taught Dave to read, not to write, but to read. And this was a great gift. A later owner, my great-great-grandfather, Lewis Miles, encouraged Dave, it appears, to write on his pots, because whenever Dave was the property of Lewis Miles, he wrote poem after poem after poem. So I think it varied. And I'm very proud of Lewis Miles. I'm proud of Harvey Drake for what they did. It makes me very happy.
Leonard Todd is the author of several books, most recently Carolina Clay, The Life and Legend of the Slave Potter Dave. He talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1214A, Reconsidering Crafts. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.